Today, after discussing Harvey Weinstein's criminal trial, we speak to Zoe Brock, one of his alleged victims who became part of the civil action against him. And the latest from Beijing on a new virus in China. As you might imagine, given what we're about to talk about, this episode contains descriptions of alleged sexual assault and strong language from the start.
I am on a self-imposed writer's retreat in the bush in New Zealand with my six-month-old, and it's peaceful and quiet. There's birds and nature, and everything is really supposed to be extremely placid and serene. Little did I know what was about to happen. I get an email. It's the first of several, ding, 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 in my inbox. And they're all from friends who have heard my story, my Harvey story, because I've told everyone this story for years. And all of a sudden, it's just blowing up my inbox as people send it to me and go, oh my God, I thought of you. And I'm clicking over links and reading the New York Times article. And it's extremely validating and huge and exciting, and it's a big aha fuck you moment. Like, we're gonna get him.
Zoe Brock is describing the 5th of October 2017 when the dam broke on a story that had been carefully contained for decades. And as the flood of allegations about film producer Harvey Weinstein spilled forth, she got that same familiar feeling that had been circling for decades.
The next day, I read the news and I immediately saw the headline that Harvey Weinstein was denying the New York Times story and the claims of all the women and was planning to sue the New York Times. And that's when the bomb really dropped for me. I remember feeling a little bit, not jealous that I wasn't in the initial story, but like, oh God, I would have loved to have been a part of this. You know, I've been trying to tell the story for so many years. Had anyone been listening, like, had I known that they were trying to find women, I would have been there with bells on, you know? And when I heard that he was not only denying it, but planning on suing them, I got pissed and pissed. And I sat down at my computer and I wrote the story, and I wrote it so hard and so fast. It just poured out of me. And to this day, I remember so much of it. It's branded into my brain. That's what trauma does to you.
A type of trauma felt not only by the two women who were the key accusers in Weinstein's criminal trial underway this week, but by dozens more, with stories that sound like they are on repeat. Women with similar experiences to Zoe, whose terrifying alleged encounter with Weinstein in 1997 does not qualify for this criminal case, but is a key part of a civil claim against him. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, why Zoe Brock is furious about Weinstein's attempt to silence alleged victims.
The briefest way that I can possibly tell what happened to me is that my Italian modeling agent, who was a very respected high fashion agent in Milan, asked me to accompany him to the Cannes Film Festival, knowing that I wanted to be an actor. That year in Cannes was ostentatious and kind of grotesque. You know, I was staying on this mega yacht with my agent, and I've never been impressed by wealth at all, but I've definitely been impressed by talent. And so that it was impressive, you know, to be around people with talent. I was taken to a dinner party and sat next to someone who I didn't know, who happened to be Harvey Weinstein. Over the course of an evening, this man, Harvey, and his friends proceeded to make me feel extremely safe and like one of the gang, one of the boys. Really fun, absolutely no flirtation. And then at the end of the evening, I was I allege that I was deliberately separated from my friends and my agent and told by Harvey and Harvey's employees that they would give me a ride because all the other cars were full. This is after many hours of partying together, and instead they pretty much kidnapped me and got me into a car going in the opposite direction and took me 45 minutes out of town to Harvey's very secluded hotel, telling me that my friends were right behind me in the next car. Then when we got back to the hotel room, they all made excuses to leave me alone with Harvey. And then I was assaulted. And I'm very lucky that it wasn't worse than it was, because, you know, knowing now what Harvey is capable of, I've had to reframe what happened to me in the context of knowing what could have happened. As it was, he did what he did to many women. He just suddenly rocked up naked without any warning, no flirtation whatsoever. Just suddenly there was a dick in your face. And I went through the four responses to trauma. I froze, I fawned, I fled, and I fought. And I happened to do them in an order that worked for me in that moment and got me out of there without being raped or murdered, neither of which, you know, seemed like a far-fetched possibility at the time.
You write about being in the bathroom, and when I read that, I felt terrified for you. And just that idea that you're trying to make your mind up in that moment and work out what to do.
Look, you know, I encourage anyone who's out there to Google and listen to the audio tape of Ambra Batalano, who was brave enough to wear a wire for the New York Police Department and go up against Harvey. And when you hear him talk to her, you hear him talk to me.
Can I stay on the bar?
No, you must come here now.
No.
Please.
No, I don't want to.
I'm not doing anything with you. I'm
now
you're embarrassing me.
I'm sorry.
It was chilling to me when I heard that recording, because it took me straight back there, being locked in that bathroom, to him pounding on the door and pleading and begging, and that rapid fire voice just sort of demanding and pleading and discombobulating you. Like, you can't even think when you're being spoken to that fast and that ferociously.
Please, I'm not going to do anything. I swear, my children, please come in.
To be locked in a bathroom by an extremely powerful, physically powerful person. You know, he was a big person. You know, he could have pinned me down and done anything that he wanted to me. And he was extremely powerful emotionally as well. He definitely had the upper hand in that situation. And yet somehow I was able to speak to him like he was a child and make him behave like one. I mean, he went from banging on the door and pleading and demanding that I come out of there and telling me, I'm not going to hurt you, I'm not going to hurt you, to me screaming at him, put your fucking clothes on, you naughty fucking boy. And him suddenly being extremely contrite and listening to me as if I was his mother and he was a bad little toddler. It's like someone slapped him in the face and he came to his senses. He just started apologizing profusely and gone into the other room. And I had to, there was this time where I had to trust that this was my only way out. That was that he wasn't going to hurt me if I came out of that room. And he didn't hurt me. Instead, he cried.
Do you think he was trying to make himself seem like a victim?
Honestly, he tugged on my heartstrings by doing that. Like, he made me feel oddly compassionate for him. But that man sat on that bed and cried, and he said to me definitively, I'll never forget it for the rest of my life, you don't like me because I'm fat. I looked at him in absolute disbelief and was like, I don't like you because you just tricked me and lied to me in this hotel room and chased me around the room naked and barricaded me in a bathroom.
And I get this strong sense of the stories that I hear, like yours, but also the other stories we've heard, that there were these people enabling his behaviour, who didn't only turn a blind eye, but actually helped him.
The guy who came to clean up Harvey's mess when Harvey called at 2 a.m. to, like, get me a cab back to Cannes and, like, get it sorted out.
We can't name the man that Zoe is talking about, a close associate of Weinstein's, whose comments to her, she says, floored her.
The person who sat one over from me in the back of the car with Harvey in the middle while Harvey was saying, I want to be your Rock of Gibraltar. I'm going to make you a star.
We can tell you that the behaviour of that man, whom she says enabled Harvey Weinstein's allegedly predatory behaviour towards her, has stayed in her brain, lingering on for more than 20 years.
The person who turned to me almost with tears in his eyes and said, "I am so sorry. Of all the women we have done this to, you deserved better. You were different." I was so young at that period of my life and so naive that I thought, oh, that's a compliment. This was a pattern of behavior that they did and that he felt bad about, and he apologized for it. He kept Harvey Weinstein's secrets.
Secrets that in Zoe's case do not only include his alleged attempt to assault her one night, but on the next, to make it clear she knew the full force of his power and influence.
Well, the next day, when I finally made it back out to my boat where I was staying, you have to realize, I mean, I was doing the walk of shame. I was in last night's clothes, getting back out there at, you know, 8 a.m. whenever the first water taxi could take me. I looked like a whore to anyone who would be wanting to see that. And it didn't help that Harvey sent 13 long-stemmed red roses, you know, a couple of hours after that with a note about what a wonderful person I was. My agent took me to a screening with our gang of, you know, 6 to 8 people, and we showed up and it was an empty cinema in the middle of the festival at, you know, 8 p.m. And as the credits started to go up and the word Miramax rose onto the screen, Harvey entered and sat directly behind me. Harvey managed to procure a completely empty theater in the middle of the Cannes Film Festival to show his power, to intimidate me.
Was it quite typical in that lifestyle for older men to kind of hang around young models and young actresses?
Ugly, tragic, rich guys fawn over beautiful young women all the time. That was part and parcel of it. You know, Harvey was not the first creepy asshole in my life, and he certainly wasn't the last.
A lot of the other women who've spoken out about Harvey Weinstein describe what happened in the moment. Many people talk about being paralysed or frozen. Lucia Evans, who was originally part of the criminal case, described sort of just giving up. The truth is, there's no right way to respond to something so horrific. But there is this sense that everyone, and it sounds like the same for you, just goes over and over and over questioning their responses, even blaming themselves. Have you had those feelings?
Look, I'm really excited that you've opened the door to this question, because one of the things I've learned while working with a lot of the victims of sexual assault, and not just Harvey Weinstein, you know, a lot of us, we've been talking, and what's become really clear is that we all have very different trauma and ways of reacting to it. You might think that if a car is coming straight at you, that you'll jump out of the way, or if someone pulls a knife on you, that you'll punch them in the face. But that's not the case. You don't know. And so there happen to be 4 responses to trauma that your brain and body send you through. One of those is freeze. You just shut down. Another one is flight. You turn around and you run. Another one is fight. And the 4th one is very specific to women, and it's extremely uncool. And that is when the brain sends, in the moment of trauma, sends a flood of oxytocin through your body, the love drug. And so in a situation like Harvey suddenly coming on to you, you're suddenly flooded against your will with a love hormone that causes you to fawn. And you start to think that if I kind of fawn with him and I play friendly with him, then I can get out of this.
Sounds terrifying.
There's not a level of comprehension that can really help you deal with that without a lot of therapy. There's shame and like, how could I do that? It's so multi-layered. There's so much that society doesn't understand about sexual trauma.
What difference did the story coming out make for you emotionally? I mean, how did it feel when you were sitting at that computer? Or was it always there at the same level?
No, completely different, because the story was always there. But because of the way that I packaged it, it became a humorous dinner party story. Like, oh my God, well, let me tell you my Harvey Weinstein story, you know? And again, I didn't know that he was a serial rapist. once everyone else's stories started coming out, and I had to repackage him from this, you know, kind of tragic dickhead to a really violent predator. And that was extremely traumatic, because had I known really, in essence, how awful he was at that time, I 100% would have gone to the police.
But Zoe didn't know, and she didn't go to the police. The scale of allegations against Weinstein finally came out in October 2017. Her experience had happened so long before that by then it was outside the statute of limitations, and so not something that criminal prosecutors in France or the US could take on. The same was true for many women who wanted to bring criminal cases against him. But there was another civil option open to them.
I was the second person to join the class action civil suit, and I did so readily and joyfully under the impression that we were doing so to change the world. Even if we got a massive judgment, which was what we hoped to get, we were under the impression that, you know, Harvey would declare bankruptcy and that we would likely never see a penny. We hoped that we could shine enough light on the situation and the complicity and potentially get, you know, a judgment that was so big that no one would ever want to shelter their CEO or whoever.
The class action involved 9 women, including Zoe, who would be making a case on behalf of hundreds of others. And alongside that, lots more women bringing individual claims against Weinstein.
So I signed up thinking that that's what I was going into. And it's somehow been turned into this settlement that, frankly, is insulting.
How did it end up there?
I don't know. That's certainly not how it was presented to me. But as it stands, I cannot commit to any part of it. But I also can't commit to objecting to it or opting out of it. I'm very, very concerned for my rights and for the rights of the untold number of women who I'm supposedly representing as a member of the class action. And I want to see the final proposed agreement before deciding, because the specifics of it are extremely important.
The settlement they seem to have reached, the final details are still being negotiated, is for around $25 million. That may sound a lot, but it has to cover more than 30 alleged victims. Plus, the class action part of the case that Zoe is involved with opens the door for many more potential claimants to come through. The payout could be split hundreds of ways. Weinstein will not pay out himself. He'll do so through insurance from his bankrupt Weinstein company. And the deal doesn't require him to admit he's done anything wrong. The agreement has been hugely controversial. And this week, a fourth woman has opted out of the settlement. Tell me why you find it so hard to stomach.
The intent of the settlement agreement, as it stands, seems clearly intended to end all litigation against Harvey and all the other defendants. And, you know, as a result, many victims might be left with just no options. Under the current draft of it, even after speaking with my new lawyers, it's not even clear whether women like me who might opt out of it will even be able to pursue their claims. That's extremely dodgy. There might be women who have really valid civil claims that are still within their statute of limitations, and they are either not ready to come forward or they won't learn of the settlement in time to opt out of it. And if they don't opt out of it in a timely fashion, they'll be forever prevented from bringing a claim.
That makes things incredibly difficult.
And one of the fascinating things I've found is that many of the most vocal dissenters to this settlement are women who already signed NDAs and regret it. And they are screaming for the rest of us to learn from their mistake. And not many people are listening, but I am. I'm really listening. There are so many women that came before us, and those of us in the class action are meant to represent every single victim of Harvey's, every single one, the number of which might be in the thousands. And we can't take that responsibility lightly. So when I think of that potential number and I try to do the math with 25 million, It just doesn't add up. There's no admission of guilt or acceptance of responsibility by Harvey. You know, there's no payment by Harvey or any of the directors. Everything's paid for by the insurance companies. The directors are getting $12 million to help pay their defense costs.
How many women are involved?
Well, there were 9 of us in the class action. There were 6 originally and then 9. Everyone knows that I have been extremely upset about this for months. And instead of, I have no answers for you. I don't get communicated with. So.
How has it felt to watch the criminal trial start?
Not good. I don't feel good about the criminal trial. I wanted to be testifying. I'm sad that I'm not testifying. I don't understand why I'm not testifying, because to this date, I'm supposedly the only accuser, in quotation marks, whose story he has not denied. And I don't know why he hasn't denied it, probably because I kept so much evidence.
What evidence did you keep?
1998 was the only year that I kept a journal, and I kept it all. I kept the letter that Harvey sent me the next day with the red roses. I have photos from inside the room, you know, the business card that I carried that night, because I didn't have a phone or a wallet, that had my agent's and everyone else's phone numbers on it, all written down. Like, yeah, I had it all.
Do you think that this criminal trial can achieve something?
The last 2 years has sort of taught me a protective mechanism, which is to sort of live in the worst case scenario. So I kind of protect myself at this point by imagining that he's just going to get off and he'll try to stage a comeback. And, you know, in a few years, the world will forget. I sincerely hope that's not the case. And I will do everything in my very limited, loud, angry power to make sure that that doesn't happen. But
is there a best case scenario?
Yeah. Weinstein goes to jail for the rest of his life and takes down everyone who helped him. A best case scenario for me would also be that the class action goes forward and, you know, we get a judgment. Again, we might never see a penny of it, but that's so big, that is so big and so scary to every corporation and business that they never shelter their golden goose. Whoever that powerful person is, they never do that, because the consequences will be so bad to their bottom dollar that they will be too afraid to.
Zoe, that's everything I want to ask you. Thank you so, so, so much. Is there anything else you want to say?
I made some notes before this, but I think we've kind of covered everything.
Thank you. That was Zoe Brock, who first published her story in a blog that you can read on her Medium page. The Guardian's Lucy Osborne has been writing about the women taking part in the civil case, so do read her stories on the website. And if you're wondering where we're at with the criminal trial, then listen to yesterday's episode of Today in Focus with Guardian US chief reporter Ed Pilkington. Harvey Weinstein denies all allegations of non-consensual sex and has pleaded not guilty. Coming up, the world responds to a new virus in China. Now, in December last year, a group of market goers in the Chinese city of Wuhan came down with coughs, fever, and aching bodies. 6 weeks later, there are more than 200 similar cases. 4 people have died, and the World Health Organization is meeting to determine whether this new coronavirus constitutes an international emergency. From Beijing, The Guardian's Lily Kuo has the latest.
The story started in Wuhan, in this seafood market, and a cluster of people got sick with this kind of mysterious pneumonia-like virus, and the common thread between most of them was that they had either worked at this seafood market or they had been there. Then in early January, scientists figured out that what this virus was is a new strain of the coronavirus, and the coronavirus is a family of viruses that can give rise to things either like the common cold or SARS. SARS was severe acute respiratory syndrome, and it started in China between 2002 and 2003. And one main reason why this keeps being brought up in relation to this virus, aside from the fact that they're from the same family of viruses, is that when that outbreak happened, officials tried to cover up what was happening and they suppressed information, and that made it much worse. So it spread to, I think, 37 other countries. Almost 800 people died. So there's been a lot of talk this time where people are scared of that happening again. They're scared of lack of information sharing. But a lot of public health experts are saying that China actually instituted a lot of reforms after that. So initially, Chinese authorities had said that there was no clear evidence that there was human-to-human transmission of the virus. They noted how none of the health workers in Wuhan had gotten sick. And so it was believed that there needed to be some direct contact with the infected animal, or if there was human-to-human transmission, it was very limited. Right now, the virus has expanded from beyond that cluster of people just in Wuhan who were somehow linked to this market to people that are very far away in provinces in the northeast, in the southwest, in Thailand, in Japan, in Korea. And on Monday, after the number of cases basically tripled, the health authorities in China confirmed that yes, this can be transmitted between humans. The other thing that makes this very worrying right now is the fact that Chinese New Year is coming up, Lunar New Year. It's a week-long holiday that starts at the end of this week, and we expect to see something like 400 million people traveling across the country. It's supposed to be the world's largest human migration. So the fact that we have this virus coming up right now when everybody is moving across the country and also to other countries makes it much more volatile. I'm in Beijing, and there's definitely a new level of anxiety since Monday's statement from China. Xi Jinping, China's leader, also made comments saying, you know, we're going to tackle this problem. So, you know, all of these statements just show that actually this is quite a grave situation, even though all the statements are saying how it'll be fine. Face masks are selling out, and there's been a lot of advice flying around about wash your hands. In Wuhan, they're doing more things to patrol who's coming in and out. They've banned large tour groups. They called off Chinese New Year celebrations. So I think in that city, we're starting to see more of a lockdown. Even just last week, we talked to some people that are in Wuhan, and nobody was that worried about it. One guy that we spoke to who used to work in this market before it was shut down said that the people who own the market had advised the people that work there, you know, don't go to crowded places, you know, wash your hands a lot, things like that. And he was just like, I don't believe in this virus. It's just, you know, it's winter, it's cold, I'll go anywhere, I don't care. And just the fact that he said, I'll go anywhere, just made me think, okay, well, that's how this gets spread.
That was The Guardian's Beijing bureau chief, Lily Kuo. Do follow this story on the website. That's it for today. Many thanks to Zoe Brock and to Lily Kuo. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.